This podcast was recorded at Hartford Street Zen Center, Isanji, in San Francisco. Please help support our temple by making a donation at hszc.org.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
So today I thought I'd talk about truth and honesty and so forth for a number of reasons, not the least of which is the world we live in right now. But I thought I'd start just by reading a little brief. We have this book here in front of us, but the page I'm about to read you is actually from Thich Nhat Hanh's training, Five Mindfulness Trainings. And it's called Loving Speech and Deep Listening. And it's the vow, if you're studying with the Order of Inner Being, it's the vow you take, or they now call them trainings, but it used to be a vow, regarding this. So it says, aware of suffering caused by unmindful speech and the inability to listen to others, I am committed to cultivating loving speech and compassionate listening in order to relieve suffering and promote reconciliation and peace in myself and among other people, ethnic and religious groups, and nations. Knowing that words can create happiness or suffering, I am committed to speaking truthfully, using words that inspire confidence, joy, and hope. When anger is manifesting in me, I am determined not to speak. I will practice mindful breathing and walking in order to recognize and to look deeply into my anger. I know that the roots of anger can be found in my wrong perception and the lack of understanding of the suffering in myself and in other persons. I will speak and listen in a way that can help myself and the other person to transform suffering and to see a way out of the difficult situation. I am determined not to spread news that I do not know to be certain, and not to utter words that can cause division or discord. I will practice right diligence to nourish my capacity for understanding, love, joy, and inclusiveness, and gradually transform anger, violence, and fear that lie deep in my consciousness. So I I've been thinking a lot about truth, as I'm sure all of us have. Partially, you know, we live in the current environment that we live in, and you know, it's difficult to, we listened this week to some very angry words between two national leaders and then the cancellation of a peace talk and all that sort of stuff. And I thought, you know, these two guys have both created a story about themselves and about each other and whatever. But then I was intrigued when I took a deep breath and a backward step to notice that we're all doing the same thing. I think some of you in this room probably have an opinion about one or both of those national leaders and what it was they were up to this, you know, in terms of scheduling talks and then canceling talks and all that sort of stuff. And so, you know, we live in this world with all this social media and so forth. So I was just intrigued and started to think about story and what is truth and what is story and what is an outright lie and what's fake news and all that sort of thing. And, you know, as most of you know, I'm a person in recovery, and so I go to a lot of meetings, recovery meetings, where a general format is that somebody tells their story. And, you know, it's an interesting process. And then at the end of that person sharing his or her story, everybody else comments on their, what that story means for them. There's a rule about no crosstalk, so the story is supposed to be your own. And it's fascinating to be at those meetings because I think what I see a lot, and it's not just recovery meetings, but it's a good way into this thought, is that people tend, if you can imagine, to embellish their stories a little bit. And so somebody goes from being somebody who drank too much and, you know, spent too much money or had too much sex or spent too much time on the internet to a very elaborate story. We used to call those drunkalogues in AA. they don't use that expression too often anymore, but that's what it used to be called. And there's this embellishment, and I was thinking about what that was about. And, you know, there's a fact. The fact is you're trying to tell a story that will be helpful to other people, and so you want it to be, you know, like a good movie. It's like I went all the way down to this level of darkness, and then I came to one of these meetings and said the Serenity Prayer, and my whole life turned around, and it's a miracle. And if it could happen to me, it could happen to you. So there's that piece of it that's, you know, trying to be of service. But then the other thing that I've noticed over the years and a lot recently is that some people also take stuff out of their stories, stuff that, you know, so they're wanting it to, they don't want to be the worst person in the room or the best person in the room, to have the darkest addiction story or the brightest recovery story. And so people aim to be invisible, essentially, so that their story sounds like everybody else's. I came from here, I've stumbled here, I moved here, I found recovery, and now I'm here. And it's like the generic version of the story. And it's designed, I think, to connect with other people. It's designed so like we're all in this together and we're all exactly the same. And of course, the fact is that that's not true. We're not all having the same life experience. And, you know, it's the absolute truth and the relative truth, which we'll talk about in a second. But you know, it's like, what is the experience that you've had? And then when we get ready to speak about our experience, what is the motivation for the words that we use and the language that we use, the meaning that we're trying to share, and I think often the service that we're trying to provide? And then as I've been here, you know, here Monday night and Friday nights, we do meditation and recovery, and I just have been really, really moved by what a gift Zazen is. You know, it's in those situations, it's basically the gift of being quiet. You don't have to explain anything to anybody, including yourself. You just sit and you are present with whatever comes up and you engage with whatever comes up. And you don't have to make an elaborate story out of it. And I recently was at a meeting, not this Sangha, where somebody said, you know what, let's meditate for a much shorter time and I'll talk about myself for a much longer time. I thought, no, there's that pendulum that we're talking about. It's like, that might not be the best idea. And I don't know the answer to that, but you know, the gift that we have in Buddhism and in meditation and recovery is exactly that we get this opportunity to use our sitting practice to get present with ourselves. You know, we don't have to have an elaborate backstory. We don't have to have a hugely anticipatory, you know, future story. We get to figure out exactly who and what we are at this particular moment. And, you know, the Buddha taught that all phenomena manifest because of conditions created by others, the dependent origination. And you know, it's like, okay, so I did this. My parents treated me a certain way, and so I became this kind of a kid. And then I went off to school and had this experience, and so I became that kind of an older kid, and through life. And it's not just alcoholics and addicts that do this. If you listen to people when they're giving a talk or a lecture, when they're engaged in conversations at a cocktail party, and that can be a good place to examine this, or if you sit in a coffee shop in intellectual neighborhoods like the Castro, and eavesdrop on the conversations around you. There is all manner of things being said that I actually had the experience last week that somebody was talking to a friend and he was telling him about a social service agency that he had created. And he was telling the story of that, complete with details. And it's a wonderful social service agency. I happen to have been involved in it in the beginning. This person wasn't there, but it wasn't just a story. He had dates and times and people he met with and things he did, and so I was just like trying to figure that out. And then finally, the other person said, "You know, I like you anyway. I'm gonna like you anyway. You don't have to impress me." And it was just like, there you go. There's what, you know, that I think a lot of us do. When we start speaking, some desire that there's a motivation, I think is what I want to say. There's a motivation when we speak. There's a motivation when we communicate. And, you know, when we talk about right speech, there's a motivation when we don't speak. Because one of the one of the ways we can hurt ourselves and each other most is with our silence, which is a form of speaking. So the Buddha talked, you know, about the relative and the absolute truth, the relative truth composed. It's, you know, there's a book over there. And the absolute truth that essentially boundless, pure perfection, true existence. And so, you know, when we start thinking about the absolute truth, it's a spiritual practice, basically. It's a way for us, and spiritual, relative truth and absolute truth, for most of you, probably, if we handed out a piece of paper right now for a quiz, there might be one person, well, everybody in the room would have a different answer, slightly. And so it's a really confusing document, concept, right? But the absolute truth is boundless and pure and perfect, right? And then if you look at the Heart Sutra, and you remember the line from the Heart Sutra, form is no different than emptiness, emptiness no different than form. Form is exactly emptiness, emptiness is exactly form. So after spending a lot of time trying to figure out what's absolute truth and what's relative truth, the Heart Sutra says, doesn't really matter. It's all things are held the same way. So in the teachings that we have in Buddhism about right speech and honesty, the first set of teachings, obviously, in the early sutras, talk about abstaining from lying and from divisive speech, from abusive speech, and from idle chatter. Anybody here been involved in any idle chatter this week? Yeah. So I think we live in a different time than what they wrote about. But what that gives us the opportunity to know is that we have a Buddhist practice, right? All of us are engaged in a Buddhist practice. And so right speech is not the simple fact of not overtly lying. Right speech is speech that is delivered with the intention, as Thich Nhat Hanh said in that first reading, the intention to nourish other people, the intention to nourish ourselves. So any speech that engenders disharmony or acrimony is speech that we don't want to do, we don't want to be involved in. People make a lot of threats. You hear people making threats as one example, and they say, well, I would never actually do that. You know, like when you say, if you do that to me, I'm going to kill you, or that will kill me, or whatever, that big language. And we know that action's not going to actually happen. It's just language. But I think what our Buddhist practice says is that when we think about the Sangha in which we live, the world in which we live, to even put out that kind of language is a practice that we don't want to be involved in. And particularly in that case, because it's not true. At its very bottom level, it's not true. So I think we have this opportunity to think of what we do as a practice. And then we think about the precepts. And the precepts, I undertake the precept to refrain from incorrect speech. And in this, Norman Fisher says that I vow not to lie, but to be truthful is the basic precept. And that he believes that the precepts are a motivation for honesty. Buddhism goes beyond, he says, being truthful. It's simply not telling lies. It means speaking truthfully and honestly. And it also means using speech to directly benefit others and not using it to benefit only ourselves. In this book that everybody here is familiar with, Being Upright, Reb Anderson talks about it and says, all speech based on self-concern is false, period. All speech based on self-concern is false and can be harmful. He says that speech based on self-concern is speech designed to promote ourselves and to protect ourselves, and that truthful speech, in the Buddhist sense, would instead arise naturally when we speak from selflessness and concern for others. So suddenly it's you know, we know we communicate with different people all day long. You know, the person that maybe makes our coffee, the person driving the bus, the person in the office next to us, and some of these people we barely know. And you know, engaging in this level of honesty and compassion and concern for some people seems like, well, I can't do that for everybody. I don't have time. And I only have a certain amount of capacity for kindness, and then it's going to run out. And we don't want that to happen before we get home to our partner or friends or whatever. And for other people, people I've talked to recently, it's my own experience from time to time, it's easier to do it with those people. It's easier to be completely honest with and nurturing. You see people who will be in the coffee shop or talking to somebody on the bus, completely gracious and completely kind. And then they turn back to their child or their partner, whoever they're talking to, and that all disappears, you know. So with the stranger, some people are able to do it because it doesn't require quite the level of investment that it would otherwise. So I was looking at some texts about right speech, and there's one that says that right speech has four parts. One, abstain from false speech. Do not tell lies. That's simple. Two, do not slander others or speak in ways that cause disharmony or enmity. So as I was thinking about that, for a lot of us, that's a challenge. Did any of you have occasion to talk about Meghan Markle and Prince Harry last week? Yeah, most of us said something, even if we said, yeah, I didn't see it or whatever. But we talked about them. Most of us, as I mentioned in the first couple thoughts I was having, most of us have probably said something about the two leaders of the two countries. And you know, the fact of the matter is that if I were to speak about those two leaders by name, which I never do, and that in fact, that what I just did is slander, right? Because I'm thinking that they are so less than that I don't even call them by name. So it's that. And so we live in a world where, you know, not everybody's operating from a pure place of kindness and love. And so, you know, we might be inclined to talk about them from time to time. We live in a world with all this media that we have, so we might be inclined. I've heard elaborate conversations about the prince and Meghan Markle in the last week. People who you would assume spent the weekend with them. They're so intimately involved in what they were thinking when they did this and what they meant by that and what it's like. And almost always, because national leaders and princes and duchesses are in a world other than ours, almost always when you hear people talking about those things, it starts out with the dress was nice or whatever, and then it ends up with some version of, you know, why her? it's like it almost always spirals into something that's less than kind. So that second one, do not slander others or speak in a way that can cause enmity or disharmony. Third one says, and here we go, none of you would have anything to do with this, but in other parts of my life I did, abstain from rude, impolite, or abusive language, right? And so in terms of being honest and using right speech, we're very clearly told that most of what passes for humor, I'm reminded that the play, the movie The Boys and the Band is now on Broadway. And I don't know if any of you ever saw it, and it spoke to a certain community at a certain time. And there were some reasons for the way people spoke to each other back in those days that were accurately and not accurately in the movie. But the entire thing is about a group of people who live in a world where they can't be themselves, work in a world where they can't be themselves, live on streets where they can't be themselves. And so when they get together in a closed door, they get rid of all that stuff that's built up in their system. And they aim it at each other, and it's supposed to be funny. And a couple of you are old enough to have lived in those days, as I am, and it was a survival mechanism. But when you think about it, in retrospect, you know, with the distance of a number of years, it's the way people talk to each other, and still do. One of the things that this play being on Broadway has brought up for people is no one talks to each other that way anymore. And again, I invite you to the graduate school laboratory around the corner called Starbucks, and just sit and listen to the way people talk to each other. And so there is that tendency, disguised as humor, a tendency to really use language that is impolite and frankly abusive. And then the fourth one in that teaching is to not indulge in idle talk or gossip. And so there are some ways that we should be able to measure whether we're whether we're sticking to the precept and to the vow for right speech. And so one of them says that one of the ways I can use to evaluate whether I'm engaged in honest right speech is does my speech include half-truths or partial truths? So you know, like the at the in the AA stories, it's like there's a basic thing there. You know, I was an addict, and I was an active addict. No, I'm not. That's the basic truth. And then you leave out some things, you add some things to make the story better. And that's an example of the half-truths thing. But I think we all do it in our lives all the time. And one of the reasons that we do that, it's suggested to us that we think about and work on, is the idea that we don't want to hurt somebody. We don't want to give somebody bad news. So maybe we work with a colleague who's really messing up her or his job, and you know, we think it's not my place to tell her. You know, it'll catch up with her or him sooner or later. And so we don't want to, you know, do that. The coming out stories for those who might have had to come out as gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, or anything else, because we all come out to parents about something. And when we were living an untruthful life, because I don't know if any of you know people like this, they didn't want to hurt them. If I told my father that or my grandmother, that would kill them. It's just easier to go along and get along, et cetera, all those stories. And all of those are ways of us manipulating reality as we know it, and us manipulating the truth. Troy Parinkoche, as you know, referred to that as ignorant compassion. Ignorant compassion. He didn't mean to insult anybody, although clearly if someone said that you were practicing ignorant compassion, it would probably hurt your feelings a little bit. But what he meant by that was ignorance in the Buddhist sense, that you just don't know. So you're not telling your parents, you're not telling your colleagues, you're not telling whoever it is, because you don't want to hurt them or you don't want to increase their suffering. But in fact, we have decided that we are the masters of the truth. And so I'm only going to tell you certain things. And then the final way that the teaching that I was reading, which is on a website called Thought Company, Thought.co. So find some good stuff in there. But it says to take care of what lawyers call reckless disregard for the truth. And so Thich Nhat Hanh talks about this, and others talk about this. And so what that means is that, you know, when they talk about in the vow, not to say things about which we cannot be certain. And so sometimes we'll tell a story, and we kind of have a gut feeling that, you know, you might be elaborating a little bit or repeating something that a friend told you to another friend about a third person or, you know, about a fourth person. And you're repeating it, and you kind of know it's like, well, it's not actually possible that all of that happened, but it's a great story. Alice Roosevelt Longworth said, never let the truth get in the way of a good story. And so what the precepts tell us is that we have a responsibility to find out before we speak things. And I think it's find out two things. Find out, A, the facts as we know them, knowing that every time a story is told, it changes. The object of the story changes. The reason for telling the story changes. So we check out the facts as best we can. And I think we have a responsibility to check out our motivation for telling the story. You know, I'm sure we've all heard family stories or gossip, family gossip, and we thought, oh, I can't believe she repeated that. Why did she tell somebody that? And then the next thought is, I can't wait to call my cousin so I can tell them. And you don't actually know if it's true because you weren't at the wedding where the event took place, whatever it was she did. But the story's kind of ripe. And so that's what the teaching says, is that just think about it as reckless disregard for the truth. So if we're saying things that we're not entirely certain are true, then we should be willing to check that out. Okay. So the late Robert Aiken Roshi talked about it this way: speaking falsely is also killing, and specifically killing the Dharma. The lie is set up to defend the idea of a fixed entity, a self-image, a concept, or an institution. I want to be known as a warm and compassionate person, so I deny that I was ever cruel, even though somebody got hurt. Sometimes I must lie to protect someone, or a large number of someone's, animals, plants, beings from being hurt, and I believe that I must do that. So he teaches in that teaching that to remember that speech is relational. So we talk and listen, although we probably talk and listen to ourselves way too much, but basically speech given to the Sangha, the community or the world, is relational. And so as we're thinking about, are these facts accurate and why am I sharing them, we also can think about, and should, as part of our spiritual practice, think about the impact of those words. The impact of them on me for saying something that I might know not to be true, and in spite of my vows and precepts to speak something into the world that's not true or that's angry. The impact on the person that you're speaking to. What does it mean for them? And then, you know, the impact, stories that you can remember from the childhoods of yourself or your neighbors where the parents were arguing and they were keeping it between them. And if one of the kids said, "Mommy, what's going on?" They said, "Nothing, just mind your own business. Daddy and I are talking," or whatever. But the kids lived with the result of those words. They lived with the result of that expressed anger and that expressed language. And so that's an example for all of us, that when we put divisiveness, accusation, things about that we're not sure of out into the world, when we speak our anger before we've had time to meditate and try to become at ease with our anger, recognizing it but become at ease with it, when we do that, we're putting all that out in the world. And so truth and right speech become not just something for us, but the relations we have with others. It becomes a practice, this truthfulness. And I don't think any of us would pretend that we do it perfectly. And I don't think we ever will. But I think what it means is that we have this opportunity to every day pay attention to what we say, and to see how what we're saying really becomes an opportunity to increase harmony in the community and to increase harmony for others. And frankly, for me, my experience and that of folks that I know, to really increase the ease with which I can live every day. The simple story when you get to be my age is that you can't speak distruth. You can't lie too often because you frankly can't remember what you said. So if I told you one story and you another story by the third day, I probably can't remember. So there's a very practical aspect of aging that can help you. It doesn't always. We all know people that still do the truth, but I think this is our opportunity to practice every day in a way that the simplest way, the way we communicate with each other, the simplest way, the way I harvest my thoughts into expressions that I'm going to share with you, the way I harvest my thoughts into things I'm going to say to you that have the potential to nurture you or hurt you, the way I use my practice to say, "Something's cooking right here. I'm beginning to feel like I'm going to say something, and that something might be angry or spiteful, and so there's no rush. I do not have to talk." Thich Nhat Hanh and other teachers say that, you know, before you speak, if you notice that you're angry or hurtful, ask yourself three questions. Is it true? Is it useful? And is it necessary? Or there are various versions of that. But the idea is that if you stop just long enough, if someone said something hurtful to you or whatever, if you stop just long enough to ask yourself some little three questions or take some moment to refocus, that for many of us, the chances are that whatever that first thought was, we would actually not ever say out loud. Another friend of mine teaches that if you feel that thought, you're harvesting some words that you're about to use, imagine if somebody said those words to your four-year-old niece. How would you feel about that? And again, partially it's that exercise of, would you allow someone to talk to your niece that way? And the answer is, you know, would probably be no. And it's also the actual practical piece of stopping long enough to ask, to formulate that question, ask it and answer it. So I think that those are important tools when we communicate with others. I think it's also an amazingly important tool when we start thinking and talking about ourselves, because a lot of the internal chatter that we get involved in is evaluating self and criticizing self and, you know, having shame and so forth. And as we do that kind of communication, often it's not true. You know, we know sometimes when we criticize ourselves, oh, I'm the dumbest person here because I didn't get the report done on time or whatever that is. We know it's not true. And in the teachings, Thich Nhat Hanh's and Buddha's and other, you know, the other teachings that we've had about interconnectedness, we know that if I think it's okay to talk about myself that way, it's not long before I also acknowledge that it must be okay to talk about other people that way. So the last thing Thich Nhat Hanh said in that article that I was reading is that right speech relates clearly to the four immeasurables: loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. And so if we think about how we speak, and we think about it in terms of those four measurables, the compassion and the equanimity, I think it gives us a structure on which we can base a spiritual practice of speaking kindly and speaking honestly and speaking for the nourishment and benefit of others. And then the last thing that I wanted to say, and then we can talk about your experiences with right speech and honesty, is that the other half of this, of course, is deep listening. Thich Nhat Hanh talks about right speech and deep listening. Deep listening, he said, is the foundation of right speech. If we cannot listen mindfully, we cannot practice right speech. No matter what we say, it will not be mindful because we'll be speaking only of our own ideas and not in response or engagement with the other person. So Katagiri Roshi said, kind speech is not the usual sense of kindness. It can appear in various ways, but we should remember that it must constantly be based on compassion. So again, speech and compassion. Under all circumstances, that compassion is always giving somebody support or help and the benefit of the doubt. So for me, it's an interesting practice because we live in a world where there's so much information out there that it's not possible for all of it to be factually accurate. And we have to figure out how we're going to work in a world where that's the case, on our jobs and with our finances and, you know, with food safety and the environment. We need to know some of what's factually accurate and what's not. And the way we do that is to evaluate the words that are spoken and the source of those words. And I think that our Buddhist practice is a gift because we understand that as soon as we start, you know, the way is not difficult for those without preferences. And, you know, we do have preferences. So we begin to evaluate for safety's sake and for accuracy's sake in terms of jobs and money. And then we watch how fast that can spin out of control. I watched somebody walk out of the bank on the corner the other day, the Bank of America, and he was saying horrible things about the woman behind the counter who had waited on him, who couldn't cash his check or whatever, and talking about how mean she was and evil she was. I had been standing right there. She didn't do anything except say, "We can't cash that check." And so he went into this whole thing. So I actually, because I don't have good sense, followed him into the lobby, and I said, "Are you all right?" And he said, "Mind your own business." I said, "Yeah, but..." I said, "You just said all that stuff out loud about that woman." I said, "And all she said was she couldn't cash the check." And then he went on to say, "She's like that all the time. She's blah, 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 blah." And I said, "How often do you come here?" He said, "It's my first time." And then he did not punch me in my face. He smiled and said, "Yeah, I guess I let the situation get out of control." But I don't think it's unusual. I mean, that's his fuse was way shorter than all of ours, I hope. At least at most times, I hope. But it's an example of what happens. It's, you know, evaluating one piece of information and we immediately go to all of the structure that we need to justify our response to that or our engagement with that. So I think the message for today is that, you know, we have a precept that encourages us to speak wisely. And most of us have taken or have thought about taking precepts that we vow to live as Buddha and to do these things. So I don't think it's 100% or 0%. I think it's a spiritual practice, and I'm happy to be on this journey with all of you. Thanks. Any thoughts or questions or lies you'd like to tell us?
Thank you for your talk. I remember recently have had my own, some own troubles with communicating, and but I recognize over the past few years how valuable it is and how what a relief it is when it actually when you actually are able to work something out with someone, how much better you feel. So it's like I'm always kind of like, well, what's the alternative? You know, I know it's hard, but it's like I know that. And then sometimes it's not always possible. It depends on there's you know multiple points of view involved or whatever. But I know your calls to mind. I heard this saying that anger is a madness that passes, and I think that's true. But it's also that it seems like it's so important to be able to handle it skillfully, because it's like denying your anger isn't very helpful either. And but expressing it to someone in a way that doesn't hurt them or yourselves is really hard. But it's also, it's like, well, what's the alternative though? Like, you know, suffocating yourself in your own anger or exploding on somebody, neither of those are very good. So, but it's really hard, honestly. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know, but I guess it's encouraging because I can look and say, well, I guess it's hard, but how about the other alternatives? Are those better? And it's like, well, mm-hmm. actually, they're a lot worse. So, I don't know.
Yeah, I think a truth that gets into that sort of place in our lives is that I'm so angry right now, I can't stand this. And the fact is, you know, most of the great teachers tell us to make friends with our anger, right? That it's there, and to ignore it isn't gonna help because it's just gonna leak out somewhere else on somebody else or poison our day or our week or our season. But to make friends with it, it's like, yeah, I'm angry. And you know, I'm angry because somebody treated me or someone I care about badly or someone help themselves, to say, you know, whatever. There's reasons for it. But the truth that gets confused in there, or the statement that gets confused in there, is that this is so awful, I can't tolerate it. And that's, I found my way to Zazen because I needed some place to be where it was like, there is nothing in the world that is waiting for Stephen Tierney to respond to it immediately. Nothing. And if I wait an hour or a day, I have found over the years when I wait an hour or a day, because I don't always, you know, there are times when being human, you hear a voice yelling at someone, you think, well, that sounds familiar, I wonder who that is. And it's me. But I think it's that piece of information that we can work with. It's like, this is not the worst thing that ever happened, almost always. And if I don't respond right now, the world will not shatter all around the outside of me. And that's a little bit, you know, if we do a little mindfulness practice of some kind right there, when we feel that coming up, like my jaw tightens up a lot when I'm angry. I've said that before probably to some of you. And I know that when I feel that, I do not, my spiritual practice is when that's happening, I do not speak at all. And the side benefit of that, by the way, if any of you practice that, is if someone's yelling at you and carrying on and acting away and you don't respond, that's what I said before about the silence. I don't do it to punish anyone, but it can make people quite uncomfortable. They're calling you names and questioning why you did something or, you know, blah, blah, and you just smile and say, yeah, we'll talk about this some other time.
I mean, I actually had that experience a couple of days ago, and I did, I mean, it was really hard, but I didn't respond in kind. I said, you know, I don't like you saying that to me, obviously, but they didn't, it still was unsatisfying because I was pissed off all day afterwards. Actually, I sat Zazen that night, and it really helped. And then the next morning, I wasn't pissed off anymore. But I still don't think it's—I don't know—it's like.
So, what might it have been like if you sat Zazen at 2 o'clock instead of 5 o'clock? Like when you were noticing that it was wrecking your day?
Might have been better. I kind of was one of those things where I just needed to kind of take care of myself all day, which I did. But it was like—I don't know though—that still it made you feel like. Seems important somehow at the right time to let that person know that, hey, you know, that made me really mad too. It's not like, I know otherwise it just seems like it builds up and doesn't go anywhere. And but I mean, yeah, there's a lot of risk in at least engaging it at the moment. If you aren't able to do it well, it can just. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I you know, I don't think you should ignore it when people are treating you unfairly or with malice. But like I say, what's helped me a lot over the years is that I don't have to respond immediately.
Yeah, I heard that.
Because, you know, I might feel better for the moment, but then that event has still taken place. That person is still malicious, if they were. And now I've also joined the party.
It just makes it snowball.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks.
Yeah. Well, this reminds me of one thing that I've thought a lot about in the last couple of years, because I've read and heard various different things from different Buddhists and different types of Buddhists about righteous anger and how that can be a force for good and compassion. And I feel like I don't really subscribe to those arguments anymore, and especially because I've seen how certain people use that to further their own idea of what righteous is, when to me that seems really damaging and wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about your perspective on that.
Yeah, righteous anger is, you know, I mean, people get angry, right? And sometimes it's for a cause. Somebody, you know, took something that was theirs or hurt somebody that they cared deeply about. But, you know, every war that's ever been fought was fought because somebody had righteous anger about a situation or a piece of land or oil rights or, you know, whatever, farming land, you know. And so the wars are always fought because two different groups of people thought they were absolutely correct. And they would do anything, defend to the death our nation or our spiritual, our religion or, you know. And so I think that idea of righteous anger is, if we think about the things we're talking about this morning in terms of using our spiritual practice to center ourselves and to have time to say, is whatever I'm about to engage in, there may have been an injustice, but is what I'm about to engage in, does it have the potential to increase harmony and to increase ease and to put forgiveness in the world and good boundaries and safety and so forth? But does it have the ability to do that? And I'm guessing that most of us in this room, when they were doing the war in Afghanistan, for instance, they decided not to, on both sides, not to use missiles that would kill people. But they redesigned all the missiles to come from the bottom of the vehicles that were coming through so that they would handicap the soldiers, the young soldiers. Because if they did that, if somebody dies, you bury them and you go on, it costs $5,000. But if you injure them, there's a lifetime of pain and aggravation and costs, and so it's really a way of doing that to the country. So I'm sorry to tell that little story, except to say that people sat in a room and discussed that. There were meetings and graphs and charts, and it was it so that they could win the war, so that they could defend their position. And I'm sure they were righteous. I'm sure they thought, you know, here's another strategy for us to win the war. And I would hope that for all of us, that at some point when we were planning our own minor, much less hateful version of that, that a voice in our head or our own natural self, our Buddha self, would speak, or one of our friends or our teacher or somebody would say, really? You think that's a good idea? Will you be able to live with that down the road after that happens? And so for me, part of my practice is, you know, because at various times in my life, I have had periods where I knew absolutely everything about everything. And during some of those, was happy to tell you all what that was. And I'm now much more available to a teaching that I can't even remember where I got it from, but that in every situation to say, what else is possible? So if you speak to me and it doesn't feel good, and I want to say, well, he's doing that because he's mean, or, you know, he's trying to get back at me for something. It's like the question is, I breathe a couple of times and just say, what else is possible? You know, might he have just gotten run over by a bicyclist in the street, or, you know, lost his cell phone, or what else is possible? And then if I stop long enough to say, what else is possible, I realize that I'm thinking about your motives and thinking about you as a human being. And oftentimes that takes me back from needing to respond immediately to, because, you know, in my experience and probably most of yours, that my immediate evaluation of why you said what you said and how you should be punished for it has almost never been fully accurate. felt good to respond sometimes, but almost never been fully accurate. And you learn that as a good Buddhist and as people in recovery and as human beings, you learn that when you have to go back later and apologize and make amends. You say, well, I thought it was just vicious of you to, you know, follow on. It's like, and you hear yourself apologizing for what you said and then trying to explain why you said it. And it's like, there's no good reason. I just said it. So I think that righteous anger thing for me is probably, I have a hard time with that because I can't figure out, you know, almost always if I'm feeling righteous, it's a delicate house of cards I'm standing on. Yeah.
Well, I don't want to come across as righteous, but I came from a family where any negativity was absolutely forbidden. So anger always had to be, you know, something unwholesome had to be done with it, namely swallowed. Mm. So I spent years trying not to do that, and went through a period of where I did the opposite. But, you know, what the hell, scream at him, you know? That didn't work either. So after many years, I actually have come to a place where I find that occasionally anger is clarifying, especially if one has the skill not to use it destructively or as a weapon. And I feel like they're the people who are so fond of, what's his name, is that whole screed against being angry, I feel like, is sort of pre-psychological. It's like it does not acknowledge how anger actually can function in our society as human beings. Mm-hmm. So, however, an enormous amount of skill and self-insight is essential.
Right.
So I would say that, sure.
Yeah, and I think that's like when people like Thich Nhat Hanh say, make friends with your anger, that's what they're talking about. It's, we all have it. You know, some of us will have it before we get upstairs from here for some reason, shortly after, when we're gardening out back. And something crawls across my shoe. So we'll have anger, but I think you're exactly right, that it's like to ignore it doesn't help. To ignore it doesn't help because it's there. And if you ignore it, it just comes back later as a resentment or you know, a sleepless night or whatever. But I think that the next step is how you're going to express it to others. And I think, you know, the way you've just shared that with us is really very helpful. It's like to do it with a great deal of skill and insight. And if our precepts are in order, then skill and insight would include not slamming somebody up against the wall. Yeah. Anybody else? Shall we go have some cookies? Maybe, or some tea anyway.
We have cookies.
Cookies and tea. My day is complete. Thanks, everybody.